Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. We trust you had a wonderful 4th of July holiday weekend. Hope you enjoyed and got all 3 days off. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, who's also the author of The Weed Agency, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for you. As usual, we start with the good, and it's almost a crazy good one, Jim, because ultimately there's still big problems being caused by ISIS. This is the group that was so radical that Al-Qaeda is like, well, we're not really sure about them. But anyway, they are the ones that are on the warpath in Iraq. They're the ones trying to establish this caliphate between Syria and Iraq, and even further, if they can accomplish that. The leader is a guy who we had at Guantanamo once upon a time named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And he made one of his first speeches as the self-designated caliph for this organization. And he has called on all of the world's Muslims to obey him as the leader who presides over you. Talked a lot about what needs to happen here. But the thing that everybody is taking away from this speech is the fact that he was wearing a really expensive watch. This is from, I believe, the Daily Telegraph. Appearing in black robes and a turban in an attempt to evoke memories of the last caliphs to rule from Baghdad, the jihadist broke with tradition to sport an ill-fitting chrome watch with a dark face. His choice of accessory, which is believed to be either a Rolex, Seconda, or a 3,500-pound Omega Seamaster, has been highlighted as jarring with the content of his controversial speech. So, Jim, if this one little move here kind of delegitimizes this guy as somebody that Sunnis or anybody else wants to follow, that's great news, but this is clearly the biggest wristwatch fiasco since George H.W. Bush at the town hall debate in 1992.
Oh, I don't know, Greg. I might put Bob Torricelli's Rolex in that category. but having said that, I mean, doesn't this sound like either a Saturday Night Live sketch or you can just easily see this being mocked? My fellow warriors of jihad, we must denounce the West. We must fight the West. We will destroy the West and its decadence and its corruption and its un-Muslim ways, except for the wristwatches. Isn't this fabulous? Look at this. It is the Omega Seamaster, 3,500 pounds. Perfect time, even when I'm diving underwater. I'm doing a very, very bad caliph imitation right now. You notice his accent is meandering all around Europe and the Middle East. But you get the idea. We oppose everything Western except for their cool luxury goods. Because, man, those are awesome. Like, in a way, this is a win for us. Because he's not holding a sundial on his wrist or anything like that. He's not going back 700 years for that. The West is that seductive, that hard to resist. Even for a guy who's pledging to call himself the caliph. It says something that you're going to have a very tough time pledging the rest of or convincing the rest of the Muslim world that they too should renounce all contact with the West and all of our joys of life we offer them. So, and again, if this makes him look like a hypocrite, if it makes him look like he's preaching one thing and practicing another, all the better for us. And it just kind of seems kind of funny that, like, at no point out he said, al-Baghdadi, yeah, the wristwatch, yeah, pull the sleeves down, okay? You know, he didn't get, no one did that to him. And my suspicion is that, you know, yes, there'll be a lot of fanatics who will say, yes, we're totally behind this guy. From this, you could easily spread the rumor that he's secretly living a decadent life full of Western pleasures.
Boy, that would never happen to a radical Islamist leader. That's never happened before.
Like those 9/11 hijackers going to the strip club and stuff like that. Yes, exactly.
Exactly. And just, yeah, I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with foreign currency conversions. It's not a really heavy wristwatch. It costs 3,500 pounds in British currency.
Which is, at least a couple of years ago, that would have been $7,000. I haven't looked at the exchange rate these days, but it's pricey, to say the least.
Yeah, the pound's definitely worth more than the dollar and the euro. So anyway, on to the bad martini now. Edward Snowden pretty much confirming what we all feared. This is from the Washington Post. Ordinary internet users, American and non-American alike, far outnumber legally targeted foreigners in the communications intercepted by the National Security Agency from U.S. digital networks, according to a four-month investigation. 9 of 10 account holders found in a large cache of intercepted conversations, which former NSA contractor Edward Snowden provided in full to the Post, were not the intended surveillance targets, but were caught in a net the agency had cast for someone else. And it's something critical to national security in most cases, Jim. Things like medical records sent from one family to another, resumes from job hunters, academic transcripts. And it gets even more significant. Scores of pictures showing infants and toddlers in bathtubs on swings, sprawled on their backs, being kissed by their mothers. In some photos, men are showing off their physiques, and others, women modeling lingerie or wearing things at the beach. So clearly this is what the NSA needs to be spending its time on.
My attitude has always been, if you're a foreign citizen, the Constitution doesn't apply to you, and we can spy on anything we want to spy on, provided it does us value. And I think, by the way, you could ask, for example, you know, does the intelligence value of what you find on Angela Merkel's cell phone worth the embarrassment of that revelation if you get caught? And I think there's a probably pretty clear open debate about whether it is. But the flip side is that, look, if you're an American, you have constitutional rights, and the Fourth Amendment is not just there for decoration. You need probable cause to start sniffing around in somebody's personal life. And you think about how much we live our lives online. You know, we think we're practicing, you know, the check the privacy box for Facebook, and, you know, the only it's going to be our friends seeing our pictures of our kids or, you know, silly pictures or something like that. Well, by golly, NSA's got access to all that stuff, and it's a bunch of Americans, and it's not what you're supposed to do there. The Post article has this really kind of unnerving section which says, many other files described as useless by the analysts, but nonetheless retained, have a startlingly intimate, even voyeuristic quality. They tell stories of love and heartbreak, illicit sexual liaisons, mental health crises, political and religious conversions, financial anxieties and disappointed hopes. The daily lives of more than 10,000 account holders who were not targeted are cataloged and recorded nevertheless. Now, early in the article, they say this, they're mostly Americans. This is not acceptable. This is not okay. And my suspicion is that whatever remaining goodwill the NSA had is going to be pretty much shredded by this, because they keep telling us not to worry about it. And here we are. We find ourselves, you know, again, Americans are being spied on without a warrant by the NSA. And a sneaking suspicion that this stuff is being retained, even if it has not been abused directly by the government, the temptation is there. And the likelihood is that someday some unethical government would then start using this sort of stuff to abuse its enemies and other things like that.
As you mentioned in the beginning, as bad as we thought, and perhaps in some ways worse than we thought. So still doesn't excuse the actions of Snowden, as some people want to do, but it definitely does raise an important issue that still needs to be addressed. All right, on to the crazy martini now, and Hillary Clinton just still can't get away from the fact that she's rich. This is according to the Washington Times. Mrs. Clinton offered an explanation for her expensive speaking fees in an interview, saying that the hundreds of thousands of dollars she charges to speak at colleges doesn't really go to her. Instead, she told Ann Compton of ABC News it all goes to charity, her family's charity, the Clinton Foundation. So all of the fees have been donated to the Clinton Foundation for it to continue its life-changing and life-saving work. So it goes from a foundation at a university to another foundation, Mrs. Clinton told Ms. Compton. Now, Jim, I know you donate extensively to the James Garrity Fund for a Better Tomorrow. And so, you know, we're all trying to find the best charity out there.
You know, way back, I'm going to say sometime in the 1990s, a sister of a friend of mine worked on her student government at one of her colleges. I don't remember which one it was. And they wanted to bring Magic Johnson to campus to talk about overcoming adversity and, you know, good stuff like that. And I remember hearing that they had to pay something like $35,000 to bring him in. And as you know, look, on the one hand, it's a free country and Magic Johnson can charge whatever he likes. And I'm sure the students loved it. I remember scratching my head saying, boy, you know, one, it's not like Magic Johnson needs the money, you know, NBA superstar for years and years. But then the second thing is this sneaking suspicion that, like, on the one hand, yes, universities put aside some money for this sort of thing. Is that really the best way the university could be spending its money? To spend a lot of money to bring a celebrity to campus to give a speech for about an hour or so. And I'm sure the students like it, but boy, it seems like a lot. Now, on Thursday before the 4th of July, I wrote about the University of Connecticut. I had said that they had paid Hillary Clinton $251,000 to speak in April. And a university spokesman wrote in raising holy hell. And at least in this particular case, University of Connecticut say, look, we had a donation from one of our, you know, local contributors, somebody up there, who established a fund solely for the purpose of bringing speakers to campus. And obviously, it's a pretty well-endowed fund. On the one hand, they can say, look, this is not in this particular case of UConn, it's not fungible. They can't say, oh, this came out of they're not allowed to use that for giving folks a break on tuition or scholarships or anything else like that. This money is just set aside for guest speakers. In that case, the beef those of us on the right would have, or those of us who just kind of wonder about the spending at universities, would have more of a gripe with the donor saying, here's a huge amount of money, but you can only use it for bringing speakers to campus. I think it is worth noting that they established this a few years ago. This is only the second speaker who has come to campus. The previous one was historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Now, for perspective, University of Connecticut tuition for if you're in-state is $23,000, a little bit more than that. Out-of-state, $42,000 per year, including tuition, room, and board. and the university's endowment is $357 million. So I think there's a legitimate gripe to be had here. The legitimate gripe may be more directly, you know, in the case of UConn, it's at the donor, but other ones like UNLV, it's the university choosing to spend this money, spending oodles amount of money to go to Hillary Clinton. And again, the idea was she'd say, well, you know, I am giving it to this charitable foundation that's in my name. I don't think she realizes how disingenuous that sounds and how much someone whose net worth is estimated to be about $200 million, people just can't understand why she would need it, why she would ask for that from universities that are hiking tuition and facing their own financial pressures. And then thirdly, kind of wondering like, well, look, if you're going to run, if everybody kind of openly acknowledges you're running for president, you know, you're not officially a candidate yet, you don't have to file the FEC forms, yada, yada, yada. But really, isn't this a backdoor way for places, you know, everything from universities to corporations to like Goldman Sachs, everybody else to kind of buy your friendship someday down the road? And it emits an odor, and I think people are completely right to object to this kind of stuff. But I think Hillary's latest excuse very much justifies the label of the crazy martini today.
Yeah, absolutely. She's just so embarrassed that she's rich, which is so bizarre. I mean, attribute it to the great opportunities you can find in this country. So
even if, again, even if you want to say, look, I am worth every penny. I am the equivalent of a Springsteen concert and Cirque du Soleil and David Copperfield and the Harlem Globetrotter. You know, like even if it's the greatest show in the world, it's one thing to take the money from a corporation. I think it's another thing to take it from a public university.
Yeah.
And people can really kind of question the educational value of spending. Again, it's not just a small amount. Really, you know, a healthily sized six-figure sum to bring a speaker to campus to, you know, do a one-hour speech and Q&A.
Yeah. I still think the money would have been better spent at George Costanza's The Human Fund. But
there you go. Exactly. Yes. Speaking of dubious charity. Yeah.
Exactly. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. He's also the author of The Weed Agency. I'm Greg Corumbus from Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch. Have a great day, everyone.